Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast. Here we bring you the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, it's the second day of testimony in the sentence hearing for Colt Gray. The Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge is now Georgia's first World Heritage Site, and Atlanta Braves center fielder Andrew Jones has finally been inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Andrew Jones was a legend in Curaçao, a great player in his own right, and I'm not standing here in Cooperstown without his constant coaching. That, we did it.
Today is Monday, July 27th. I'm Peter Biello, and this is Georgia Today. Thirty years ago this week, all eyes were on Atlanta as Georgia hosted the Centennial Olympic Games. It was just a week into the Games when nighttime revelers in the newly completed Olympic Park were rocked by a deadly terrorist explosion. It resulted in the deaths of two people, and more than 100 others were injured. Then CNN journalist Henry Schuster was working at the CNN headquarters just yards from the bomb attack. He and the CNN team worked around the clock on this story. A suspect was quickly and wrongly identified, and it would take 8 years to bring the right man to justice. Henry Schuster is also a former 60 Minutes producer and author of the book Hunting Eric Rudolph. He joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Peter.
So you were among those who first reported on Richard Jewell, the man who found the suspicious backpack that eventually detonated. For those who weren't following this story 30 years ago, how would you describe what went wrong with the FBI's initial investigation?
So much went wrong. They were operating off of a playbook from the Los Angeles Olympics. During the Los Angeles Olympics, there had been a law enforcement official who had identified what he said was a bomb being planted on a bus full of Turkish athletes. Turns out he was the guy who planted the device himself, and then he called it in and he got that. So the FBI had built that into their profile. And then the day after, well, actually, it was right after the bombing, we had worked around the clock. We had heard about this security guard, Richard Jewell, and we got him into CNN Center, and we brought him in there for an interview. And amongst the people watching that interview was a man who had been his employer, the president of Piedmont College in North Georgia. He calls the FBI and says, you know, there was something strange about this guy. So the FBI put two and two together and got seven. And that's how Richard Jewell wrongly got in the frame for 88 days.
That was a very difficult time for Richard Jewell, and that's been documented, well documented in the public sphere. I want to ask you about something else, though, which is the mood in Atlanta after the bombing, because I've been told by some that the games did resume and they resumed rather quickly, but I can't imagine things felt the same after the bombing.
Well, they did and they didn't. I mean, there was a great deal of consternation. There was a lot of anxiety. Was the bomber going to strike again? Who was the bomber? You know, in one sense, the wrongful identification of Richard Jewell calmed a lot of the anxiety because people thought, okay, we've got a suspect, threat over. Let's just move on. But of course, they got it wrong. And if they had it sort of admitted their mistake, there probably, ironically, would have been more anxiety about the fact that the bomber was still out there.
Hmm. So how did the FBI first get on the trail of Eric Rudolph?
It took three more incidents. It took the bombing of a clinic in Sandy Springs. It took the bombing at a gay nightclub in the Piedmont, on Piedmont Road. And then even after that, they were still coming up short. They were doing all sorts of forensic analysis. They got a letter claiming responsibility, but they were still stuck. And it was only after another bombing that took place early on a morning in Birmingham, Alabama, at an abortion clinic that led to the chain of events that led to Eric Rudolph being identified. Somebody had sort of tailed him, gotten a license plate number. They called that in. An APB was put out. They traced that. They went looking for Eric Rudolph. They didn't really have a good address for him. By the time they showed up at his trailer the next day, he was ready. He had dropped off returned some videos to a video store. You know, he went through a drive-thru, got burger and fries. He went to the Bilo grocery store where he was in North Carolina, did a lot of shopping, They paid careful attention to the shopping list. And then by the time they knocked on his trailer, he was gone. And he was gone for 5 years.
Wow. And so what ultimately led to his capture?
You know, I think it was more exhaustion on his part. It was 5 years later. A deputy was driving behind a grocery store in Murphy, North Carolina, saw some scruffy guy who looked like he was dumpster diving, put his blinders on, put his brights on, hauled him in. And pretty soon it became evident this was Eric Rudolph. You have to imagine by the time Eric Rudolph was caught, attention had shifted away from him. Remember, now it's 2003. So when I got the call that Eric Rudolph had been caught, and this was only a few hours after he had been identified, I get a call early in Saturday morning, and I hear a voice say, "We got him." And I'm thinking, "We got who?" And at first it's like, is it Saddam? Because I had just come back from Kuwait and Iraq. Is it Osama? Because he's been gone since Tora Bora. And then when I heard the accent, I realized they were talking about Eric Rudolph, which shows you how much priorities had shifted. At the time that he disappeared, the FBI was saying this was the biggest manhunt, you know, across the mountains in the Appalachian Mountains in that part of North Carolina. But that had all pretty much gone away. There was only a very small squad based in Atlanta that was looking for Eric Rudolph at that point. And I won't say they were doing the minimum, but they certainly weren't doing the maximum.
So when you reflect on that time, the time of the Olympics 30 years ago and what happened in the aftermath of the bombing, what comes to mind first for you? What stands out prominently?
The confusion, the chaos. There had been a group of kids, teenagers, they were got called the Speedo Boys because they had come from a Speedo exhibit. And they like checked out the backpack apparently, and they knocked it over on its side. And what that did was that caused the bomb when it went off for the explosion to go upwards. So there were nails embedded across the street, four and five stories up. If that had been directed at the crowd, then the loss of life would have been far greater. The damage would have been far greater. So that was those guys, the Speedo guys, fortunately, you know, they thought there might be beer in the backpack. And that simple act saved so many lives. This could have been so much worse.
Henry Schuster is a former CNN journalist and author of the book Hunting Eric Rudolph. Thank you very much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Testimony continued for a second day in the sentencing hearing for Colt Gray, the Barrow County teenager who shot and killed four people at Appalachie High School in 2024. Gray pleaded guilty to 55 counts, including murder, on Friday, and faces a maximum of life in prison with the possibility for parole. Attorneys spent this morning questioning forensic psychiatrist Kevin Richards, who interviewed Gray.
Never thought he was even close on insanity. Never thought he had schizophrenia. Never thought he had bipolar disorder. So if he was trying to convince me he had them, he did a poor job because I didn't see any evidence for it.
The judge will decide Gray's sentence after also hearing from defense witnesses. The widow of a Rockdale County official has filed the first wrongful death lawsuit stemming from the biolab fire in Conyers, GPB's Pamela Kirkland reports.
Shamita Johnson alleges toxic chemicals released after the 2024 fire caused respiratory injuries that led to the death of her husband, Kenny Johnson. Johnson collapsed after testifying before state lawmakers 9 days after the fire. Attorney Mindy Bish doesn't represent the Johnson family, but she is preparing personal injury cases on behalf of other residents. Asked how many people her firm represents, Bish said,
"I think at this point we have almost 500 residents. I expect that that will grow."
Biolab and its parent company declined to comment on the lawsuit. For GPB News, I'm Pamela Kirkland.
The Metro Atlanta City of Holly Springs is filing a lawsuit against the state of Georgia over a bill passed by the legislature and signed by Governor Brian Kemp earlier this year, GPB's Sarah Callis reports.
Holly Springs Mayor Pro Tem Michael Zenchuk says House Bill 1029 is creating confusion about how the city will run elections in November. He says the changes remove some residents from city limits in 2027 and change how council members are elected.
What I do not want to see is a resident of the city of Holly Springs who is responsible for paying taxes towards the city but doesn't have an equal voice to be able to choose his or her government.
The bill, sponsored by lawmakers from Cherokee County, redraws corporate boundaries in the city and adjusts the structure of city council. The Cherokee County delegation released a letter in support of the law and said that the city is wasting taxpayer dollars on unnecessary litigation. For GPB News, I'm Sarah Callis.
The Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge is now Georgia's first World Heritage Site. The United Nations Cultural Agency, UNESCO, over the weekend made the designation official at a meeting in South Korea. Kim Bednarek of the Okefenokee Swamp Park highlighted the massive wetland's diverse ecosystem in an acceptance speech.
The Okefenokee is a place where nature still reigns. Across more than 400,000 acres, water, fire, peat, and thyme continue to shape an intact wetland, reminding us that conservation is about protecting the natural systems that sustain life itself.
The designation places the Okefenokee alongside natural wonders like the Grand Canyon and important historic sites like the Great Wall of China. Its boosters say the designation will increase tourism and education. A North Georgia nonprofit is turning kayaks and fishing rods into opportunities for veterans to find peace and camaraderie. The group Heroes on the Water gets veterans out for afternoons on the Chattahoochee River. GPB's Ellen Eldridge reports.
While access to mental health care can be a challenge, an afternoon of free kayaking and fishing has been lifting veteran spirits for years. Josh Back is the Heroes Chapter Coordinator for the Chattahoochee Valley River area. He's also a combat veteran who served in Iraq and still struggles with traumatic memories, but not on river days.
It's not therapy. It's just, hey, I'm out here, me, a couple of my friends, we're out here paddling around, having a good time, cutting up, and fishing.
The most recent data available estimate 200 veterans die by suicide every year in Georgia. For GPB News, I'm Ellen Eldridge.
Longtime Atlanta Braves center fielder Andrew Jones was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame over the weekend. Jones is the first native of Curaçao to reach the Hall of Fame. In a speech yesterday, he honored Curaçao and his father, who died 10 years ago, for teaching him to play.
Aaron Jones was a legend in Curaçao, a great player in his own right. And I'm not standing here in Cooperstown without his constant coaching. That, we did it.
In Jones's debut season with the Braves, he became the youngest player to homer in World Series history when he homered twice against the Yankees in Game 1. For his dozen years with the Braves, Bobby Cox, who died earlier this year, managed the team. Jones thanked Cox yesterday.
Nobody in the Braves organization had a bigger impact on me than manager Bobby Cox. He put a 19-year-old in the World Series in lineup and believe in me.
Cox also was remembered by the Hall of Fame at the ceremony. Jane Forbes Clark, chairman, board of directors of the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum, said this.
Known as the ultimate player's manager, his calm but very fiery demeanor led him to a major league record of 162 ejections. A member of the class of 2014, he became one of the game's most revered managers.
Carlos Beltran and Jeff Kent also were inducted into the Hall of Fame this weekend. Now a story about another Braves outfielder. Ronald Acuna Jr. is coming off the injured list today after missing almost 7 weeks with a left hamstring strain. Acuna is expected to be available for tonight's opener of a three-game road series against the New York Mets. The five-time All-Star is hitting .251 with 7 home runs, 22 RBIs, and 15 steals so far this season. His season has been shortened by 2 hamstring injuries. He missed 15 games in May with the same injury. When Acuna was placed on the injured list on June 9th, the Braves topped the majors with a 45-23 record, and they led the NL East by 8 games over Philadelphia. Atlanta struggled in June without Acuna, but has rebounded somewhat since the All-Star break. Acuna also has suffered two serious knee injuries over his career. Braves manager Walt Weiss recently said he expects Acuna will play primarily in right field, his normal position. And that's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening. We've got a lot more coming your way this week, so you won't want to miss a thing. Make sure you subscribe and check out gpb.org/news for the latest updates to the stories you heard on the podcast today. Now, if you know about something cool going on in your community, something newsworthy, we'd love to know about it. Send us your news tips as well as your feedback on this podcast to georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you again for listening. We will see you tomorrow.